Welcome back to Read Into Something. We're about to start another Grave podcast episode brought to you by the Stone County Library. As always, I'm Alice, the branch manager. At my side is Winky, my mostly silent but intuitive co-host and the library mascot. Do the thing, Wink. There have been some dark, dark times throughout history. In fact, if you look back, most of history is pretty ugly. Sadly, today we're turning our eyes towards some historical royal families that got the short end of the stick. Grab your dusty old tomes, your reading glasses, and hang on because it's about to get deadly in here. It's clearly dangerous to be royal. Seems like there was always someone plotting against someone else in an attempt to gain the throne. I don't know when the first person decided it was his God-given right to be king, but I'm pretty sure that person had his enemies. Lines of succession weren't always clear, and that leads to even more trouble, as we'll see. Any kind of murder that involves children is sad. Unfortunately, there's a lot of that going on in this episode. I want to start off by taking you to England in 1483, shortly after the death of King Edward IV. His son, 12-year-old Edward V, is declared his successor. Young Edward had a residence at Ludlow Castle in 1473 under the care of his mother's brother, Anthony Woodville, 2nd Earl Rivers. I don't know what any of that means. I couldn't find any mention of where his mother or siblings were. He was 3 years old at the time, with no family except his uncle to be found. Weird. I did some reading and learned that Richard, Duke of York, who is Edward V's younger brother, and this gets confusing because there are so many Edwards and Richards. Anyway, Richard, Duke of York, wasn't originally with his brother at Ludlow Castle. His mother had him at Westminster Abbey, but when Richard sent for little Richard, he was eventually sent to the Tower of London, where the boys waited for Edward V's coronation. And waited, and waited, and waited some more. Accounts show people seeing the princes on the grounds, and historians are certain that Edward was treated for an illness shortly before people stopped seeing the boys. Their mother was holed up in an abbey with her daughters, fearful of Richard's wrath because he straight up murdered her brother and his brother Edward IV's half-brother for no apparent reason. Even though he'd previously said he wouldn't do that. I think he might have been a tad untrustworthy. Now, one might stop to think that perhaps the sons of George Plantagenet, Duke of York, and Richard's older brother would protest to Richard taking the throne. As it turns out, George famously fought and lost to Edward IV, and his family was stripped of their titles and eligibility to inherit the throne. Oops. Richard, ruling England as the protector, scheming to establish his claim to the throne, gained it in June, when Ralph Shaw announced that Edward IV was betrothed to Lady Eleanor Butler. He'd married his son's mother in secret. The contract made Edward the Elder's marriage to Elizabeth Woodville invalid and reduced his sons to illegitimacy. Shortly after, the princes living in Tower of London never reappeared in recorded public view. As far as justice goes, Richard III was a terrible king. He married but never produced heirs. In 1485, Henry Tudor invaded England and Richard was killed in the Battle of Bosworth. Henry then ascended the throne. So that leaves us with the question of what happened to the princes in the Tower. It was largely assumed that Richard III killed his nephews. Some accounts say the boys were smothered with pillows. Others suggest they were stabbed to death in their beds. Today, no one knows what happened to the princes. Richard never answered for the disappearances, although Henry was more than happy to say that Richard was a vile person who spilled the blood of infants and committed many more heinous crimes. In 1674, while renovations were occurring in the tower, the workers discovered the skeletons of two children. Ding, 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 we've found the victims. It was assumed that they were indeed the remains of the murdered princes. They were laid to rest on the order of King Charles II in Westminster Abbey. May the royal children rest in peace. Too bad they were murdered. That's tragic. But then, everything returned to normal and people went on their way. Story over. Until 1789. St. George's Chapel in Windsor Castle is getting some work done. Workers accidentally open and rediscover the tombs of Edward IV and Elizabeth Woodville. On a side note, I think it's great that Elizabeth got buried with Edward even though the Parliament declared their marriage non-binding. Another chamber is discovered containing the remains of Edward's offspring who didn't survive childhood, George and Mary. Except, In 1810, in what's now called the Albert Memorial Chapel, two coffins were discovered. An inscription on one coffin has the names Georgius and Edvardi. Google couldn't translate the inscription, so I have no idea what it says, and I'm certainly not attempting to say it out loud. Do you want demons? Because that's how you get demons. We know that Mary was buried next to George because there's a funeral account that says so. Right. Now we have two missing princes and four skeletons. Which really brings up the question, why were the two kids found in the tower buried under a staircase? Okay, you're the king and you've murdered these poor fatherless boys to gain the crown. You have to get rid of the bodies somewhere. Did he have someone dig a hole and dispose of them, then order a staircase built over the grave? Weird. The body that is assumed to be Mary's was wrapped in heavy wax cloth, but there was no mention of what George's body was wrapped in. One way to positively identify George would have been to say, look, this is a very small child, whereas these other two skeletons are roughly the size of a 9 and 12 year old. I'm going to assume Mary was buried in a dress and she would have stood apart. Alright, to be fair, George was probably buried in some sort of baby gown, but the size difference between a 2 year old and a 14 year old is pretty obvious. Now, we have a whole new question. How did the bodies get into the tombs that everyone previously believed to be George and Mary's? Did someone in connection with their deaths arrange to have them taken to be laid with the rest of the family? If so, who are the children from beneath the staircase? Sorry, that sounds like a bad horror flick. I suppose all in all, it's a miracle that any bodies were there because the tombs had been ransacked. People stole bones and hair and whatever else was loose and easy to grab. Apparently at the time it was pretty easy to put small bodies in there willy-nilly because no one was paying attention. In any case, whoever's in charge of royal bones refuses to allow any testing to be done on these mystery skeletons. Here's another theory about Edward and Richard the Youngers. There is a rumor from the Daily Mail, a UK-based newspaper, that claims Da Vinci-style clues suggest King may not have killed his nephews, but instead sent Edward V to live in secret. The article is loaded with photos and explanations, so be sure to check that out in the links. There was also a claim from a man named Perkin Warbeck, who first claimed to be Edward V, then later recanted and said he was Richard of Shrewsbury, Duke of York. He was acknowledged by several notable royals, then led a rebellion against Henry VII. But when he heard the king's army was coming, he ran away from the battle. He was later detained, confessed that he was Perkin Warbeck of Dutch background, and then he was hanged for lying. And that's what you get for going up against a king with a lot more power than you. Well done, sir. What happened to the princes in the tower? Were they cloistered away in hopes that people would forget them, then brutally murdered by their uncle or one of his lackeys? Or did Elizabeth Woodville make a deal with Richard III to send her sons into obscurity? One account says she believed they were dead, but it brings up the subject of why would she allow her daughters to attend Richard's court if she feared him? Who knows? Without DNA testing, the mystery of the bodies beneath the staircase and those of the abandoned nameless in the tomb shall remain a mystery. Where do kings get crowned? On their heads. Not to make light of current events, but the following is a subject that has fascinated me for a couple of years. We're going to talk about the Romanovs of Russia. The story of the Romanovs definitely contains the murder of children. No mystery about what happened to them. Not since DNA testing was done to confirm the remains of the last two bodies discovered in the, Koptiak Forest in 2007, 15 meters from the rest of the family and household. The missing bodies, Tsarevich Alexei and Grand Duchess Maria, were subject to myth and legend. Most people believe the missing Grand Duchess to be Anastasia. There were claims throughout the years of people posing as the long-lost Romanovs. I have to admit, the cartoon version of Anastasia is one of my favorite movies. Who doesn't love a talking bat and a happily ever after? Well, Nicholas II, Tsar of Russia, and his wife Alexandra, Fyodorovna, might have fallen in love and led a fairy tale life in Alexander Palace, they didn't get the happily ever after. They got fear and bloodshed. Russia has long been a hotbed of political unrest, as we well know. Things started going downhill for them around the time Alexander II and Alexander III got into it over his father's mistress and some political stuff. It's complicated. Alexander III was much rougher and didn't act as royal as some of his predecessors. He preferred to be among his people. That's something that Nicholas II inherited. Always he told his children that they must love and understand their people. Except that the Romanovs lived lavishly while thousands of Russians died in World War I and starved in the streets. The Russian subjects were also unhappy with the fact that Nicholas had married a German princess. Being at odds with Germany, they didn't care for her ways. And she didn't really care for theirs. She made little attempt to appease the public. The details have a very Marie Antoinette feel. Despite their glamorous lives, the Romanovs were hiding a dangerous secret. They had four daughters, none of whom could inherit the throne because of a declaration by Paul I that women could only inherit if every member of the male line was deceased. When their first daughter was born, they were okay with it. Sometimes daughters happen. Then they had another. Well, okay, but hopefully the next one is a boy. Fate laughed at them and gave them two more daughters before Alexandra finally gave birth to Alexei in 1904. Yay, Russia has a future emperor. That secret I mentioned? Alexei suffered from hemophilia, or the inability for his blood to clot properly. The royal family hid this from the public as long as they could. To have a Tsarevich with such a weakness would surely give the people another reason to frown on Nicholas and Alexandra. Things get worse because of course they do. A monk named Grigory Rasputin worked his way into Alexandra's good graces by promising to cure Alexei's disease. With Nicholas away at the front, Rasputin had Alexandra's ear. There are a lot of sordid rumors that the two were having an affair, as Rasputin was known for his promiscuity. The Russian people felt that Alexandra allowed Rasputin to make decisions regarding the running of the country, and they weren't happy about it. During the war, Nicholas was more of a figurehead than an actual commander, but he was away and losing, and his capital was rioting for more rights for workers. The Duma, a group of legislators who were meant to represent and help the Russian people, were at a loss to help them. The Duma was another step toward Nicholas's downfall. It took absolute monarchy away from the Tsar. With unusually cold weather, food prices soaring, 1.7 million Russians dead in the war, and Nicholas seemingly unwilling to do anything about this, the Bolsheviks began their rise under Vladimir Lenin. During the February Revolution, the Duma attempted to form a provisional government. In doing so, they gave Nicholas the option to abdicate the throne. By giving him an option, I mean they said, look, you're abdicating, pick an heir. Knowing that Alexei would be unlikely to inherit, Nicholas named his brother Grand Duke Michael. Michael, unaware of Nicholas's plan, woke up pretty confused to be the new Tsar of Russia, especially since he'd kind of gone out of his way not to become the Tsar. He married a divorced woman. Ooh, scandal. In the end, he said he'd only accept if the people voted to have a Tsar or if they wanted another kind of government. With Nicholas forced to abdicate, Alexei physically incapable of commanding, and Michael, no dummy about what was happening in his country, the Romanov regime ended. What to do with the former Tsar and his family? Alexander Kerensky, the new prime minister, ordered the family to Tobolsk. That's over 1,700 miles away from their palace in St. Petersburg. For a while, the Romanovs lived a quiet life. Then, the Bolsheviks seized control. Security was tightened, and the friends the family had made among the soldiers were replaced. They were no longer allowed to walk to church, their income was reduced, and the health of Alexandra and Alexei began to decline. In April, they were transferred to Ekaterinburg, specifically to the Ipatev house. If things were tight under Bolshevik rule for the Romanovs before, they were worse now. Eventually, they had to rely on the kindness of the local nuns to get them eggs and bread. They were given something like half an hour outside every day, and a wall was constructed in front of the house so the townspeople couldn't see what was going on. The Romanovs heard rumors that the White Army planned a rescue. At this point, they were glad to be together as a family, even if their circumstances were greatly reduced. Even as they lived a restricted and simple life, they awaited a trial for Nicholas in Moscow. But that never happened. Word came from Moscow to Yakov Yurovsky, head of the guard at the Ipatev house, that the former Tsar and his family were to be executed. Alexandra had previously instructed her daughters to sew jewels and small valuables into their corsets and clothing. They hoped that when they were freed, they would still have enough to let them get by. Early in the morning on July 17, 1918, Yurovsky ordered the family into a finished half-basement in the house. He told the Romanovs that they were about to be moved elsewhere due to an anti-Bolshevik army approaching. The girls, minus Maria, wore their hidden jewels. Nicholas carried Alexei downstairs, and Alexandra requested chairs as her sciatica was particularly bad and Alexei was weak. Yurovsky arranged the Romanovs, telling them they were going to have a family photo. Then he read a statement ordering the family to be executed. Nicholas said, "What? What did you say?" Yurovsky repeated himself, and then proceeded to lead the onslaught of bullets that rained down on the Romanovs. Nicholas was the first to be shot. The girls survived the first rounds from the firing squad, thanks to the jewels sewn into their clothes. But they were bayoneted and then shot in the heads. Here's where the rumors about one of them surviving come in. Because of those jewels, it's said, most likely Anastasia, was carried from the house and placed into a truck with the bodies of her family. However, she was taken and nursed back to health by either a soldier who regretted his part in the war or a loyalist. Definitely check out the Wikipedia page for a list of imposters. They have some fascinating stories. The fictional work I Was Anastasia by Ariel Lawhon was really good. I won't give away what happens to her, but the character Anna Anderson presented some very convincing evidence that she really was the Lost Grand Duchess. Anna Anderson was in fact the most famous of the imposters. She died in 1984. She's real, but the book is fictional. There are numerous works based on her lies. However, in reality, none of the Romanovs nor their servants survived that morning. The bodies were loaded into a truck, taken to an abandoned mine shaft where they were stripped, tossed into a pile, their bodies doused in sulfuric acid, and finally the soldiers threw grenades into the pit. Somewhere along the way, they were also burned. It wasn't good enough because the mine shaft was only around 9 feet deep. The bodies would be too easy to discover. I believe at this point, when they were raised from the shaft, this is when Alexei and Marie were buried apart from the rest. I'm starting to question the effectiveness of Russian grenades because on Lenin's orders, Alexandra's older sister, Elizabeth, was dumped into a pit with some others, and two grenades were tossed in as well. No one died from them, according to the story. Until I started researching for this podcast, I was unaware that Elizabeth was murdered simply for being the one who encouraged Alexandra to marry Nicholas. She was a nun after her husband was murdered and apparently did a lot of great work for the citizens of Russia, but because she was a loyalist, she had to go. The takeaway is that murder is bad, and early in the 20th century, you were likely to survive an explosion from a Russian grenade. You might not be glad you survived, but it was possible. Back to the poor, abused body of Nicholas's family. They were further disrespected by more acid, more burning, and their bodies, particularly the skulls, were crushed by rifle butts. There are some really gruesome accounts of what these soldiers did to the bodies, but I can't get into it because it's too disturbing. What's especially tragic about this case is that no one would help the Romanovs. At the beginning of their imprisonment, Nicholas was hopeful his cousin King George V would help them relocate to England. The king kind of turned a blind eye on the situation. Granted, they were fighting World War I at the time and doing pretty poorly, so he had a lot on his plate. One would think Nicholas's mother, who was exiled to her home country of Denmark, would have had some pull to get her son and his family out of Russia, although she didn't approve of Alexandra. It's noted that she was rather fond of her other son George, and I don't really think Nicholas was anyone's favorite. Denmark was never really a power player in Europe anyway, so there's that. I believe the ruling family was actually pretty poor. In 1919, a box of remains including bones, gems, congealed fat, and a severed finger identified as female, belt buckles, insignia, and other items were collected from the burial site. It was easy to see where the truck hauling the bodies had gotten stuck in the mud. This box was evidence of the murders, although the Soviets wouldn't admit to it until 1926. It wasn't until 1979 that the remains of the first 11 people who died in 1918 were uncovered. Russian scientists enlisted help from other countries to identify which remains belonged to who. They were dismayed to find Alexei and at the time who they believed to be Anastasia were missing, thus fueling the rumors. The Tsar was canonized in the year 2000. The remains are interred in St. Petersburg at Peter and Paul Cathedral. I've read a ton of stuff about the Romanovs. Initially, I felt really sorry for them, based off my review of the movie Anastasia. Well, it's not very factually accurate. I can't even remember why I got interested in the family, but my obsession took off. I still feel sorry for them, but it's clear they weren't innocent in what happened. Nicholas was a weak leader, which is interesting given his family line, but I suppose there can be a weak link anywhere. I don't feel as sorry for them as I used to. Alexandra refused to change to meet the needs of her people, although I didn't give her enough credit for the services she did perform. She and her daughter served as nurses for the Red Cross, and it's said that Nicholas was friendly and courteous to the people he met. The dire circumstances in Russia just weren't favorable to his reign. Really getting engrossed in the history of what happened to them, you can see all these little steps that lead to the end. When I read books about them, there's always part of me that hopes that the end of the story changes. Because the government was under Soviet rule for so long, no one was punished for murdering the family. It's utterly insane and frightening to see how these extremists committed murder in the name of the law. Since Nicholas abdicated, and it's questionable whether Alexei would have survived to adulthood, I don't see any reason to execute them. The only answer is it was done from sheer hatred. But like I said before, that's history for you. It's usually dark and ugly. Next time on Read Into Something, we'll dive deep into the mysterious places and cultures like Atlantis. We'll look at evidence of whether such a place and a couple more could have existed. Remember, if you enjoy Read Into Something, please leave us a review or a rating. It means a lot to us. Thanks. Don't forget to check out the Stone County Library Facebook page. Read Into Something also has Twitter and Instagram. Find us at twitter.com/sclcpodcast and Insta at instagram.com/sclcpodcast. Plus, our webpage has every episode. Simply go to podpage.com/read-into-something. Did you know I also do craft tutorials on YouTube? You can find them at bit.ly/sclcvideos. Until next time, Allison Winky out. Disclaimer, views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this podcast belong solely to Alice, not necessarily to her employer, organization, committee, or other group or individual.